Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Examining Income Inequality in America. Recorded in 2007, Dennis McQuestion, former clinical professor of corporate governance and executive director of the Institute for Excellence in Corporate Governance at the University of Texas at Dallas, Robert Reich, former secretary of labor under President Clinton and professor at UC Berkeley, and Byron Schlomach, chief economist at the Texas Public Policy Foundation, discuss income inequality and the American middle class. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
The issue of income and net worth inequality is spoken of by some as creating class warfare. Some people make more money and others don't make as much in actual or relative terms. On this program, we'll define the problem, we'll look at what is causing it and explain to you why this is or is not a serious problem. And to help us are two experts, one of which is in a studio in Berkeley, California. The former Secretary of Labor under President Clinton, Robert Reich. He is professor of public policy at the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of 10 books, and his newest book is due out soon called Supercapitalism. Mr. Secretary, how are you today?
Well, I'm just doing fine, Dennis. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. I want to show a graphic right quick. And this was a poll taken by the Wall Street Journal and NBC just a few months ago. It says that the most important economic issues facing the country first was gas and energy prices. Second was the gap between rich and poor. Third, the federal budget deficit. And then there were some others, unemployment, taxes, et cetera. But Mr. Secretary, let me ask you this. This gap between the rich and poor, this income and wealth inequality, why is that a problem? Explain it to us, please.
It's a problem because, first of all, if more and more assets in the country become concentrated in fewer and fewer hands, it could corrupt democracy. Because we know historically that in societies where most of the benefits are going to relatively few people, those few people have the resources with which to pay off politicians, legally or illegally, inundate politicians with lobbyists and special pleadings, and basically turn politics and democracy in their direction, undermining the faith that most of the rest of society has in the democratic process. Inequality also can be a problem if more and more of those assets get concentrated in few hands with regard to subsequent generations. If those subsequent generations, and again, we know this historically, are inheriting a great amount of wealth, they are making investments that basically are not grounded in any practical experience or practical knowledge about how the economy runs. And yet those become critical investments because there is so much asset concentrated in so few hands for the rest of us. We are all dependent on investment decisions made by people who really don't know very much, haven't worked a day in their lives. Basically, the most work they do is speed dialing their investment advisor. So there are other problems. I mean, we know in the 1920s, and for example, the last time we've had inequality on this level, there was a backlash against international trade, against immigration. A lot of people felt very frustrated. They were not seeing a piece of the action. They felt that they were working very hard. And the result of that was isolationism, jingoism, a kind of America first-ism that led to the end of global trade, the Smoot-Hawley Act, anti-immigration harangues, and ultimately made the Depression even worse. So, look, some inequality is going to be with us inevitably. The question is how much before we snap, how much before we essentially become different societies, a small society of the very, very rich, and then a much larger society of the rest of us who are anxious about our incomes and worried about our standard of living.
Okay, well, I appreciate that very much. And sitting here in the studio with me is Byron Schlomach. He's the chief economist for the Texas Public Policy Foundation. He's director of the Center for Fiscal Policy Studies. Now, Byron, you've heard what he has to say. Do you agree with his analysis?
Well, I agree with his analysis in the sense that if you have a group of people that are continuously poor or the same group of people continuously rich, you can have a problem. You will have a stratified society. I think that was a problem in Europe, has been a problem in Europe. I don't think that it's really been that much of a problem here in the United States. The fact is that very few of the people who are in the bottom of the income distribution stay in that income distribution for any great length of time. Over 10 years, the vast majority of those people will move up. Now, on the other hand, you have some movement out of the high income distribution level. I think it's plain to see that sometimes people who inherit wealth don't use it in the wisest way possible. I think that's apparent to anyone who looks at things. But at the same time, there are a great number of people who are very wealthy who didn't inherit wealth and in fact earned it themselves. Our wealthiest people today in our society were not the wealthiest people 50 years ago, and their families weren't the wealthiest people.
Okay. Now, let me stop you there, Mr. Secretary. The issue that he brought up here is these income groups, and we usually look at in the quintiles, the 20%, have historically, I think you would agree, had a lot of movement in them. People have moved up and in many cases, of course, down that chain. I think you may have concerns as to whether that is still happening. Tell us about that.
Well, according to studies by the Urban Institute, Isabel Sawhill and others, income mobility has actually reduced. It's slowed down over the last 20 or 30 years. And part of that is due to the fact that the entire income ladder, going from the poor to the rich, is now so much more elongated than it used to be. So even though people may move up, they have much a longer trip to undertake to get to a high level than they had in the 1950s and 60s when we had so much lower a level of inequality and that income ladder was so much shorter. But there's something else going on as well. According to researchers, again, Urban Institute and others, they have found that the single most important determinant of your income or your children's income tends to be family and parental income. These days, and we've seen it increasingly over the last 30 years, if your parents are very wealthy, they can afford a very good school for you, a very good education, a very good post-secondary education. They have the contacts with regard to their friends and other associates that get you a good job. On the other hand, if you're very poor, the chances are you don't have access to a very good school. You may not have access to higher education at all. Your parents don't have the contacts and connections. You don't even see examples of many professional people who are doing very well. And what the researchers have found is that these concentrations of very poor and very rich, geographic concentrations, have become more intense and larger than they were 30 years ago. That is, if you're very poor, it's harder and harder to break out of that circle of poverty. If you're very wealthy, it's more and more likely that you'll stay in the circle of wealth.
Okay. Now, I'm going to ask you in a bit why you think those things have happened other than just that, and of course, what we should do about it. But first, I want to play a short video. The National Center for Policy Analysis, which is a think tank located here in Dallas and in Washington, D.C., had a meeting about 6 months ago, and Pete DuPont, who's the chairman, moderated a discussion between a couple of folks that most of you know, Fred Barnes and Mort Kondracki. If we're ready, let's run that video and hear what they had to say.
You have to remember, with Democrats, there are certain issues that that are not empirical. They don't care about the evidence. They're theological. And so even if reducing the tax rate on capital gains produces more revenue, builds a stronger economy, creates much more investment and more jobs, they want to raise it because they're afraid that somewhere, some wealthy person in America is going to benefit from it. They don't care about all the people that got jobs as a result. It's theological, so they want to, these are the kind of things they want to do. Now, they had one point about the economy that they don't have anymore, but it's a point that is more descriptive than anything else, and that is that wage gains followed by several years, the growth in the economy, the growth in productivity, wage gains are always the ones that follow, and now they are picking up quite smartly, mainly because of the success of the economy, and wage gains are bound to continue. But Democrats, of course, will pretend like they're not there. Well, there is a sense of insecurity where people don't have lifetime employment anymore. Their health insurance is not portable. Their pension plans are not as portable as they need to be. Their wages are not as connected to productivity as they used to be. The lag time between productivity gains in the economy and having it show up in your paycheck is much delayed. Basically, wages have been flat for 5 years. They're constantly argued to by the Lou Dobbses of the world that globalization is a disaster, driving incomes down, hollowing out the middle class. It does happen to be a fact, by the way, that whereas CEO pay used to be something like 50 times the average worker's pay, it is now something like 500 times. CEOs are doing wonderfully well, workers are not doing that well, and all this is being used as an argument to do something. And what I'm terribly afraid of is that one item that we didn't mention on the Democratic agenda is a virtual end to free trade agreements. The president's authority, fast track authority, to negotiate trade deals with other countries comes up for renewal next year. In a Democratic Congress, you can forget about it. It is simply not going to pass. Even the Vietnam trade agreement, that the president's going over to Vietnam for this conference, everybody thought that the Vietnam trade agreement would be an easy thing for him to do. It's really no skin off our nose. It was not passed by a Republican lame duck Congress, and it's not clear that it's going to be. We're witnessing the Lou Dobbsification of the American public. I hate to give credit to a CNN anchor, but he is the demagogue who has a lot of influence over people's minds about stuff like this. Now, it seems to me that it is up to conservatives to try to figure out what does it take to get workers back on track. I mean, what does it take in education reform? What does it take in training reform? What does it take? Perhaps there ought to be wage insurance. That's an idea that comes from liberals, but maybe that's an answer that can protect people against this new kind of economy to save capitalism, if you like, from Lou Dobbs.
Well, Byron, I'm going to start with you. We're talking about saving capitalism from Lou Dobbs. One of the things that Mort Kondracki mentioned and that Robert Rice just mentioned as well is the concern that if we get too much of this inequality, that we're going to go back to what happened in the first part of the 20th century, the trade issues, the immigration issues that we had then. How would you see that?
Well, for one thing, I don't think people see the inequality issue in the general public the way it's being portrayed by policy people, especially Secretary Reich. For one thing, there is a great deal of movement from one income spectrum to another. The fact is the biggest issue there is probably education. And to the extent that we have people concentrating in pockets of poverty, the issue there is probably education as much or more than anything else. The solution to that, if anything, is to get government out of the way and let people have a choice about where they get their education. The other issue is when you look at income inequality and you look at these statistics that supposedly show that income inequality is increasing, in fact, you see that the real issue is single-person households. We have a lot. In fact, I believe there are 26 million more people in the highest income quintile than in the lowest income quintile. A lot of that is because you simply have households, and they do these statistics by households, that are headed by single individuals and very small families.
Okay. Thank you. Secretary, let me ask you to respond to what Fred Barnes and Mark Kondracki said on the tape, and then respond to this idea about single-family households, which I think is one of the issues that we're all concerned about.
Well, first of all, as to Fred Barnes, he was talking about Democrats. We haven't really entered the wonderful world of partisan politics yet on this program, and I don't want to be the first to enter that thicket. I'm not going to try to defend Democrats or assault Republicans. I think there's too much of that going on television these days anyway. With regard to Mort Kondracki's point and the point that I made about the relationship between inequality, economic insecurity, stagnant wages on the one hand, and the Lou Dobbs effect. I think the probably Mort Kondracki is giving Lou Dobbs too much credit. It's not just Lou Dobbs. I mean, there are people, demagogues, if you will, all over America who are blaming foreigners, blaming immigrants, blaming trade, blaming China for all that woes the American middle class, all of the problems of stagnant and declining wages and insecurity and so on. The point is that all of that builds up and is having a political impact. We now see that trade and the trade agenda is in jeopardy in Congress. We see that it's not just Democrats, but also many Republicans are becoming much, much more protectionist. Obviously, there is a very strong anti-immigration feeling in America, as well as an anti-trade feeling. So we are seeing all of the things that we saw in the 1920s, or at least many of them, in response to very similar economic phenomena, because in the 1920s we had, that was the last time we had inequality on the level that we are seeing it now. Now, with regard to income, mobility, the issue
and single-family households.
And single-family households. Let me just say that with statistics, you can do a lot of things, and you can argue whatever you want to argue by showing different kinds of statistics. I don't know many economists around America any longer who dispute that wages, incomes, and wealth are becoming far more unequal than they've been at any time since the 1920s. Many mainstream economists point to the late 1890s or 1880s as the last time we've seen anything like this. So I'm just giving you the mainstream economist view. There is very little dispute about what's going on. The question is it a problem? We've talked about that. What's causing it? Hopefully we will talk about that. But in terms of the actual disparities growing, again, no matter what you can do with statistics, that is the consensus view.
Okay, here's a question from the audience.
Some believe that an unprecedented flow of philanthropic dollars will occur over the next 10 to 20 years. How would you anticipate those might impact the inequalities we're discussing?
That's a great question. Byron, I'll start with you because, you know, he's talking about all this wealth being transferred. A lot of it, some of these kids are going to be wake up and find that it's going to go to their favorite causes. What would you say about that?
Well, overall, I think philanthropic causes tend to equalize the distribution of income. I think, in fact, that's one of the problems with our current income statistics is that they don't take that into account very well at all. What we tend to look at is purely wage earnings and some redistribution programs from the government. So if anything, we'll tend to see a greater equalization. And to the extent that the kids don't inherit, I think that would work to positively from Secretary Reich's point of view.
Yeah, I'm not going to give Mr. Secretary much of a response. I would say you probably agree with some of that. Would that be true?
Yes, although philanthropy, again, according to a lot of studies that are out, in fact, there's one study by a fellow from Stanford University, a very good researcher, who has the unfortunate distinction of sharing my name. His name is Rob Reich, but he's not me. But according to his studies and other studies, a very large percentage of philanthropy is going to museums, art galleries, prestigious universities, concert halls, all sorts of places where rich people do hang out or where they want their children to go to university. A relatively small portion of philanthropy is actually getting down to the poor. So I don't see how we can rely on philanthropy to solve the problem of poverty in America. It hasn't solved it so far. I'm all in favor of philanthropy, but let's not fool ourselves into thinking that that is a major solution.
Okay, before I get to this other question here in the audience, I'm going to give you, I think it was Henry, we got it from Henry Manny, the definition of globalization, because I know you want to talk about what's causing this, and you talk a lot about globalization and technology. So here's the definition. It's on graphic number one, which is what I'd like to see right now. Graphic number one, this definition, I don't know if you've seen this, Mr. Secretary, I'm going to read it to you. The question is, what's the truest definition of globalization? The answer is Princess Diana's death. The question is, how come? And the answer is, an English princess with an Egyptian boyfriend crashes in a French tunnel driving a German car with a Dutch engine. driven by a Belgian who was drunk on Scotch whiskey, followed closely by Italian paparazzi on Japanese motorcycles, treated by an American doctor using Brazilian medicines. This is sent to you by a Canadian using Bill Gates' technology, and you're probably reading this on your computer. And finally, that computer that uses Taiwanese chips and a Korean monitor assembled by Bangladeshi workers in a Singapore plant, transported by Indian lorry drivers, hijacked by Indonesians, unloaded by Sicilian longshoremen, and trucked to you by Mexican illegals. That, my friends, they say is globalization. Now, Mr. Secretary, how's that for a definition? Have you heard that one before?
I haven't heard that one before. It's a pretty good one. I don't know what to make of it, except be very careful who is your driver through dark tunnels.
No kidding. Now, talk to us about.
But I think the truth there, and a very important truth, is that there is something new about globalization. It's not even primarily trade any longer. It's direct investment. It's communication technologies. It's immigration. It is the spread of culture, the spread of ideas. That's really what this new globalization is all about.
Okay, and does that enter into why we're having such changes in the workforce that's causing some of the problems with the jobs and the income that you're talking about?
I believe so. I think that the two major forces that are driving a wedge in the American workforce, indeed driving a wedge in the European and the Japanese and Chinese workforces for that matter, are number one, globalization. Because if you are well educated, well connected, globalization is a great boon to you. You have a great demand, a greater and greater demand, a worldwide demand for all of the skills and insights and connectiveness you have. But if you are relatively poorly educated, don't have much skill, certainly don't have the connections, then globalization may be taking your job away and pushing you into the local service economy. Retail, restaurant, hotel, and hospital workers, among others, where wages are very low and where you don't have much chance of breaking out. Technology is doing a very similar thing. If you got very good education, very good skills, very good connections, technology is giving you greater value. Your productivity is enhanced. But if you don't have those things, technology is replacing you. Your job is being replaced by software that can do it much quicker and more cheaply. And again, you are shoved into the local service economy where you're likely to have very low wages.
Okay, here's another question and comment from the audience.
Yes, Dennis, I'd like to hear your guests talk a little bit more about the political implications and social implications of growing inequality. Since the Greeks, we know that to have a healthy democracy, you need a large middle class and a very vibrant middle class. Do you think the American middle class is in danger of disappearing?
Byron, I'll start with you.
Actually, I don't. I think it's probably going to begin to grow a little bit as baby boomers start retiring. Now, a lot of them are going to have enough wealth saved up that their incomes are going to keep them in the middle class, even though they've retired. I think a lot of, when you look at the income inequality statistics, part of it is the fact that the baby boomers are moving into their highest income earning years. And that pushes up the income, the high income level of the end of the income spectrum. And as they begin retiring, they'll be retiring into the lower end. The fact is, we have a very dynamic economy, and people who are working in service industries have a lot of opportunities to move up, to enhance their skills. If anything, what we need is a more dynamic educational system, because studies do show that that is the single biggest factor determining whether you're at the low end of the income spectrum or at the high end.
Okay, now, Mr. Secretary, I would assume you probably agree with him on education, but the idea that was posed there, too, is are we losing the middle class, and is that a concern for you from a political standpoint?
I am concerned. Byron, I do agree with you about education, and I hope we can come back to that. In terms of the middle class, well, it depends a little bit on how you define the middle class. If you say the middle class is from $15,000 a year to $150,000 a year, essentially almost everybody, because almost everybody thinks or aspires to be in the middle class, then we're not losing the middle class. But if you actually look at the median wage, and you see where it's gone, and you look at the clustering of incomes around the median wage, you find that that old bell-shaped curve is giving way to kind of a lumpier a demographic, where you have some people who are making a huge amount of money, who are at one end, a lot of people who are making less and less at the other end, and that middle is shrinking. The net result is you don't have necessarily the resilience of democracy that you had before. And meanwhile, as I said initially, and I want to emphasize this again, the political process is more susceptible to all sorts of corruption. Because people who are very wealthy have the resources to ensure that their wealth is maintained, to fight off anything that will take away their wealth, to promote subsidies and special benefits for themselves and for their families and for everybody around them. And that leads the rest of the population to feel like the dice are loaded. You know, why should I bother? This democracy is not mine. It belongs to the fat cats.
Well, exactly. And one of the problems is we all know is corporate welfare, which is a term that we all know and love. We don't have very much time left. I want to look at graphic number two very quickly. And this is a relatively recent poll. Actually, it was in the Congressional Budget Office. It's not a poll. It's CBO numbers that show that from 1991 to 2005, the poorest 20% of Americans' income increased by 78%. The second quintile is 23%, the middle class 18%, the fourth 22%, and the richest 20% 54%. So they appear to do pretty well there, but of course they do move in and around those classes. Now we just have 15 seconds left, Byron, for you, and I'm going to let the Secretary clear it with the last 15 seconds.
Well, I agree that there is a problem when people perceive that government is loaded in the favor of certain groups in our society. I think that's an argument for more limited government. I think that's an argument for a much smaller government, a government that people can't use in that way.
Okay, I like that. Mr. Secretary, last words.
Well, you know, we need national defense and we need homeland security. We need social security. That's a major program and we certainly need it. Medicare, highways, roads, bridges, police, fire. I mean, I don't know. When people talk about no government or a smaller government, I don't know quite what they're talking about, because most of what we mean by government are things that we find pretty important and pretty essential to us. And finally, let me just say that average wages are going up. And I agree that average wages are going up, but averages don't tell you very much about what's happening to the middle. I mean, I'm
and unfortunately,
less than 5 feet tall.
Unfortunately, Mr. Secretary, we're out of time, and I apologize for that. And you're exactly right. I appreciate that. We'll be at another program on a different subject with you shortly. And, you know, for those of you watching, you and your family and friends are going to confront this issue for the rest of your life. Our challenge to you is to ask you to educate yourself and constantly stay abreast of what folks like our experts are thinking and saying, because they are the opinion leaders, whether you like it or not. Thanks for joining us as we talk about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.